Hi there, Daniel Browning with you for Into the Music, music features and documentaries on RN. Today, we travel to two Aboriginal communities in the Daly River region in the Northern Territory, Wat Eyre and Beluan, on the Cox Peninsula. They're part of the National Recording Project, which is documenting Aboriginal song and dance as it's performed today, as well as seeking out old recordings held in city archives and making copies so that music can be taken back home and heard again by the people to whom it belongs. Producer Gretchen Miller joined ethnomusicologists Alan Marrett and Linda Barwick at Wat Eyre, which is about 200 kilometres southwest of Darwin, and then in Beluan, to witness a new way of discovering and maintaining traditional song and culture. The National Recording Project started in 2004, and it's made up of many smaller research programs. Each documents thousands of traditional songs as they're being composed and performed, each with detailed notes on who performed them and what they were about and more. Instead of the music being recorded onto tapes and taken away to vast archives in the southern cities, it's recorded digitally and stored on solar-powered local computers in those remote communities. New music, as well as the old recordings, made by the anthropologists Strello, Stanner and Elkin, are being given back to families and relatives of those original songmen. In this program, we'll hear new songs passed on as well as old, and in particular, a fresh song. We'll hear some of the words of that song to begin our story, a song that was just given to a Beluan elder when this program was recorded back in 2006. She has since passed away, and Aboriginal people listening are warned that the program contains the names and voices of the deceased. This is Ghost Songs, produced and narrated by Gretchen Miller.
This is from me. I was sitting singing. This is from me. I was sitting singing. This is from me. I was sitting singing out at Marbulup. I'm always picking tamarind for him. This is from me. I'm swimming. He's laying way down there at Marbulup. I swam. I came back to Marbulup, holding the canoe.
The music is everywhere. Every place has songs coming like water from the rocks, from fresh springs under the sea. Sometimes the birds sing it to you. Sometimes it's the mermaids in the dam. Sometimes it's the ngutj, the walakanda, ghosts. Each line of poetry reveals the hint of a story. Who is the story from? Who is the man lying down at Marbulup? And the canoe? What happened to the canoe? Down at the camp, there's a video on. Everyone's talking about it. The kids gather round. On it, Marjorie Bilbil teaches her new song to her nephew, Roger Yarrowin. There's lots of laughter. After, I sit beside her on the dusty concrete veranda and record the song. We put it on CD and a dozen copies are made. Everyone wants one. You can hear it soon. But right now, it's the end of our visit. The men are singing and dancing in celebratory corroboree down beside the clear green waters of the baby dreaming waterhole. Beluan.
All the songmen that I was working with in the 80s and the early 90s have passed away now. I recently was talking to some people and I made a list of all the songmen who passed away, and there were over over 20 people that I'd worked with that have now passed on. And I think there's always this feeling that the tradition's dying. But the other side of that is that, you know, everybody who's written about these things is always talking about how it's almost finished. Strato was saying that back in the 1930s. Stanner said, you know, in the 1960s, well, if people at Port Keats, if these things could have been recorded properly in the 1940s, maybe there was some way in which the tradition would have carried on, which just seems very strange when you're there in 2001 or even 2006. And there's a living and vital musical tradition going on there. It might not be exactly the same as it was before, but people are still creating songs, they're still singing for rag ceremonies, they're still singing for circumcisions, they're still singing for, you know, just this afternoon I was sitting down singing with people, you know, outside somebody's house in the afternoon. So it's still going on.
Alan Marrott is a professor of musicology at the University of Sydney. Alan and his partner, the internationally renowned archivist Linda Barwick, who's also a musicologist from the same department, are visiting Port Keats and Beluan. Alan's been coming here for 20 years.
So now we're going to listen to a song that Amrose made.
Like, you know, before, that all the time, you know, singing that song now. And this time, all finished now.
And what's that song about, Ambrose? What are you singing about?
Kinmel.
Ambrose, you can't see this on the recording, but Ambrose was just showing how that seagull. He's a wonderful dancer, this man. So often he shows you things with dancing and not with words, eh?
Well, I'm singing man. I'm singing man too, and I'm dancing man too.
Yeah.
And then Kariwuru Teddy. So you want to show me that?
Kariwuru.
So he's soaring away, up high in the sky. Soaring away.
On my first day at Port Keats, we sit around a laptop at the Wadair Aboriginal Languages Centre with some of the elders from the community, Clement Chinbra, Jeannie Jongman, Ambrose Pialam, and another woman who passed away recently, so can't be named. We spend several hours in the gentle, dry season warmth of the afternoon, painstakingly checking through the meanings of songs previously recorded. Alan's been entrusted with much knowledge by elders long passed away, and that now just a few hold. He tells me there are three main song genres for the area, with a fascinating historical role in community cohesion.
One is Wanga, which is owned by people whose country lies to the north. The second is Lierga, which is owned by people whose country lies to the northeast of here, on the Moyle River. Jumba, which is owned by people who live in Wadair, and also people whose country lies to the south of here. Historically, when the mission was formed here in 1935, for quite some time, it wasn't economically possible to accommodate everybody in the town, and so they had a fortnightly shift system where one group of people would come in for 2 weeks into town and work in town, and then in the next 2 weeks they'd go out bush, and the group that had been out bush would come into town. But after the war, the mission became economically self-sustainable for, you know, a larger group of people. So everybody came into the mission. And in fact, what that did was to create a situation where a number of groups who had been traditional enemies and who'd been fighting were suddenly, you know, living together in this town, as it were. And we know that there were, you know, numerous quite serious fights around that time. And so what happened was that the elders got together and basically decided that they would set up a system where each of the three main groups would have their own genre of songs that referred to their totemic beings, their ancestors, their country. Okay, so when ceremony was being performed, a group could call on one of the other two groups to perform for them. So if you were, say, a Wonga person who was wanting to have one of your sons circumcised in a ceremony, you could call on Jumba people to perform for you, or you could call on Liatka people to perform for you. Or similarly, if you're a Jumba person, you could call on Liatka or Wonga. And all the evidence was that, you know, that did work. It did actually produce social cohesion.
You might be familiar with the idea of history songs about the dreaming and the activities of the world-creating ancestors, songs that are eternal, which have been sung the same way for countless generations. They're usually secret, not for outsiders, but only some traditional Indigenous music is restricted listening. In fact, anyone can listen to the songs we're hearing, just for the pleasure of it. And though they're traditional, these are new songs. They're being composed all the time.
You know, they're not songs that were laid down as foundation documents at the beginning of time. They're songs which are dreamt into being by individuals, which may perish with those individuals, may even drop out of an individual songman's repertory in the course of his life. They're about people's individual experiences with their deceased ancestors. They are an interaction for that time.
This story, then, is about the passing on of music. The digital and the spiritual are the two systems of transmission here, travelling side by side. The digital way ensures the passing on of songs to those not yet born, songs that might otherwise disappear with their singers. From hard disk recorder and microphone, they go to community computer and then to personal CD or MP3 or cassette as part of the National Recording Project. But of course, there's a much older way of passing music down, deeply spiritual, seemingly ephemeral, yet powerfully enduring, the giving of songs by ghosts, through dreams, to the living people. It's no coincidence that in Belyuen, the word used for a recording is the same as the word used for a song-giving spirit, Maroi. Let's go back to Belyuen, where the elder Marjorie Bilbil and her family are gathered. Marjorie is seriously ill, her face wrapped in a white bandage, her mouth swollen. She's tired from her medication, but she's still strong. She's determined to share with us her rare new song, and she sits and welcomes us.
Your people are welcome to come and listen to my song. This is the song I'm going to sing. Karanganai ngulane parnongongia My name is Marjorie Wilbur.
Your first song, your song that you wrote, can you tell me the story of what it's about?
One day we went from Wilbur travelling along right through Mabuluk. We stood there for a while. We were walking around and eating some food, like tamarind. We was looking some long yam, and we clucked on a tamarind tree. After that, said to one person or two, "Go and see them. Boat still there, the dinghy." So they went off. They found this boat was drifting away.
The boat was drifting away?
Yeah, it drifted away, and this boy saying that he was so scared. And this other old man went and jumped in quickly, so fast. And he swam. He found something, maybe shark followed him. He swam so quickly and jumped in the boat. He was frightened of the shark. So he jumped in and lucky he brought the dinghy back.
Otherwise, you might still be down there. You need a dimmer nap.
That's what happened.
Yeah. That song? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Was there really a shark or did he just think it?
No, really there was a shark. Yeah. Want to grab his leg, I think.
And the rest of him.
Yeah. There was me, Beth, my sister Gracie, Rossi, Rilo, Henry Jarrow, and who passed away not long ago, and Dave Timber that lived at One Mile Dam.
In one boat?
In one little boat. We was scared too, a little bit time. That boat.
Marjorie Bilbil is talking about a unique song she received in a dream from a ghost just a few days before we visited Belyuen. When Marjorie sings, she moves her hands round slowly, gathering tamarind. There's a lot of joy and emotion around the camps because of this new song. It's rare for a woman to receive a song from a Ngutj, a ghost. Rare for a woman to sing. It's also the first new song for the community in some years. The Ngutj gave the song to be passed on to Marjorie's nephews, Roger Yarrowan and Lenny Berber.
I was lying down in my dream. Devil spirit came out to me and sang that song. They were singing that song to me. So I have to sing it for him, Roger, because I know his language.
You know the spirit language, yeah?
Yeah. Mm.
That
Ngutj, was that Emiyangal, that Ngutj? Yeah. They're all Emiyangal people from that place.
And the Ngutj is a spirit.
Yeah, the spirit, like the old people, you know, when they was passed away before.
Mm.
They still live there. Like when you go and sit down somewhere, it's in the bush. you might find somebody making noise. That's the spirit of somebody.
This song is also precious because the Ngutch, the spirit that gave it to Marjorie Bilbil, was that of a much-loved and very talented didgeridoo player in Belyuen. He was another of Marjorie's nephews, and only in his 40s. He died unexpectedly sometime after the boat trip and can't be named because the proper ceremonies have not yet happened. But his musical prowess, his presence in memory, is constant round the camp while we're there. When his music is played, men walk away in tears. Like other Wonga songs, Marjorie's clearly shows the blurring between the living and the dead, the Ngutch, the Walakanda.
Because these are songs that are given to living people by their deceased ancestors, the songs and the dances, when they're performed, it creates a context in which, for example, the living are dancing as the dead. And in that process, the living and the dead sort of mingle. Some people talk about dancers actually becoming the dead, becoming the Walakanda. Other people I've heard talk about the Walakanda actually coming in and dancing behind or beside people who are dancing. But because when a singer is singing these words and singing these tunes, he's actually singing something which has come from the dead. It does create a situation that is in some ways neither entirely of the living or entirely of the dead. And it is this liminal context. I think this is the sort of benign side of the rag burning, particularly, you know, that final ceremony. There's a lovely song that I was actually working on today that has a text that says, "Your father is not alone. He's sitting here beside me." And this is one of the dead, through that singer, conveying the message from the other side that, you know, your father's passed away, but he's not alone. He's with us. He's over here with us now. There's something that is, which is, I think, is comforting for the living about that. I think it's also reassuring for the dead person to be able to hear their living relative singing and to be able to feel the pulse of the dancing on the earth and those sorts of things. So you've got this thing where they're burning the rags and driving out the spirit of the person and saying, you know, okay, you've got to go now. But the music and the dance is a much more, you know, gently persuasive, if you like, element of the whole thing.
There's also the place where we are, close to the Daly River, where these songs come from. Mm. It's also about tide, and when you fly over the landscape, you can see how shallow the slope is of the sand out to the sea. Mm. And so the tides travel a long way in and out. Mm. And the edge between the sea and the land, it's not a stable one.
I think that's why it's referred to in songs quite often, because it's a sort of metaphor for liminality. As is the evening or the morning, as you pass from the night into the day and you're in this period of transience where things actually appear rather insubstantial, you know, or with the tide beating on the shore and the tide coming in and the tide coming out. I think those things do, you know, they refer to liminality.
A Walakanda stands and sings to me about Barada and Mangamari. They look at the top of Yandili Hill, where the trees and grasses are standing up like hairs on the back of the neck. The tide is always coming in on us.
How are the songs created or received? Speaking of the dead.
Speaking of the dead, yeah. Well, I mean, normally people receive songs in dreams, and normally they receive them from their ancestral dead. So, you know, the Marachaban people whose Wonga we were listening to today, the living call the dead Walakanda. And so Walakanda appear in the dreams of a Marachaban songman and give him the song. What happens next is really interesting, because it seems that what's actually given is not usually a perfectly formed song. I think it's possible that people have different practices about that. Perhaps for some people they come into their minds more fully formed. other people talk about having to do a lot of work, you know. Philip Mullenbrook, for example, told me that when he gets a song in Dream, he may walk around for as long as a month thinking about how he's going to get the words straight and how he's going to fit the words with the music and how he's going to fit that with the stick beating. And when you listen to his songs, they're incredibly complex songs, and you can see the work that's been done on them. And he sings them exactly the same every time. But also, having said that, there are some songs that people say they've just made up, that people don't attribute to the dead or to their dreamings or anything like that. They say, no, you know, like Slim Dusty, people will say. Like Slim Dusty makes up a song. We just make up a song.
Alan Marrett, and you heard one of Philip Mullenbrook's songs about Wallacunda there too. Back in the electronic realm, Dr. Linda Barwick is director of Paradisic, the Pacific and Regional Archive for Digital Sources in Endangered Cultures. As well as recording and analysing song texts and music, she keeps the background information on thousands of songs in order and keeps tabs on the song lists on various community computers. We sit and talk in the cool, darkened living room of a teacher's house at Port Keats.
I have a bit of a equity thing about this because it seemed to me that one of the great advantages of digital technology was that you could offer the same kind of quality listening experience in the home community as you could offer in the archive, because the sort of cassette copies that you could take away from other archives were usually fairly inferior quality compared to listening to the original recording. And so really it was only if people from those communities travelled to Canberra that they got to listen to the really nice quality recordings. And so I actually travel to various archives, the Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies and also the ABC Radio Archives and the Elkin Collection at the University of Sydney, and did digital dubs from the original tapes wherever possible, so that we were actually using the earliest generation copy to deliver the material locally.
And not only that, but you'd have to be able to say, I want this, and ring up the library and say, can you get it to me? So you have to know what you want. You have to know who to contact. You need the access to those resources that if you don't know that the recording even exists, why would you go hunting around for it?
Yeah, well, that's true. And often, especially with the really early recordings, there wasn't enough metadata with them, basically, to identify who the people were. And in fact, the earliest ABC recording is a Peter Hemery recording that was made in 1942. People from Bellion, Delisseville as it was then. And Peter Hemery was an ABC war correspondent. And so he happened to record the earliest recordings of Wonga that we know of in 1942. But for reasons of national security, he couldn't say where he made the recordings. So in the radio program, it says, this is Peter Hemery reporting from somewhere in northern Australia.
This is Peter Hemery broadcasting from somewhere in Australia to bring you the songs of some really native Australians. Time means nothing to the Aborigine, and it was hours before the tribesmen, with the help of a full moon, felt in the mood to produce the didgeridoo and get on with the job. This, like many of their songs and dances, has no story. It's just an expression of emotion or feeling. It's called a wonga, or ninte ninte.
So it wouldn't be until somebody nosy like me comes along and says, what is in this nice early 1942 recording? Sounds like wonga, sounds like something I've heard before. Take the recording back, people recognise the singers and can tell you all sorts of stuff about it. So that's another one of the early recordings that is really very much valued by people at Bellion, because it's like their grandfather's or even great-grandparents' generation now.
The very day after we record Marjorie Bilbil's song, Alan, Linda, Linguist Liz Ford and I go to the Beluan Community Council with Marjorie and two other elders, Alice Jorick and Esther Barenjuk. American anthropologist Beth Povinelli is also there. We sit in the boardroom around the laptop again and play segments of song for hours, while some of the men, Anthony and Ian Bilbil and Roger Yarrowin, wander in and out and join in the discussion about the text and its meaning. Marjorie leans forward and listens intently to her song through a headphone held to her ear. She listens back to make sure it's good and laughs when we all get it straight.
Okay, so maybe we can go back and start at the beginning, because I know you, Liz, wrote down the words with you yesterday, but just to make sure we've got them straight for that recording.
Yes,
Karangai.
So is what you say, Karangai Nanayi?
Yeah.
That's from me?
Yeah, it's from me.
Ninindadat Manda.
Mandayi.
Mandayi. Yes. I was sitting singing that song.
Yes.
Is that right?
Is that something that the Nguch was singing?
Like that Nguch, I mean, sings to Roger. I mean, sing him like him from that spirit.
Mm-hmm.
It's like even giving him song.
So
that was in your dream.
Yeah.
That Nguch was giving that song to Roger.
Yes.
Lachnai is the Nguch.
Yeah.
So he's saying this one's from me.
Yeah.
To Roger.
Yeah.
So you were watching that?
Yeah, in the dream.
In the dream.
Mm-hmm. From Port Keats, we'd driven to Darwin, past clear, rushing creeks, across the muddy width of the Daly River and through the spindly scrub. The grevillea is in flower. I met Dr. Liz Ford there before we all went on to Beluan. A linguist and research fellow with Sydney University, Liz has worked with Alan and Linda for the past 15 years. She points out there may be only 20 fluent speakers of a language, or even fewer. Languages can be so different that even people from neighbouring communities may not understand each other, though they will still sing each other's songs. Songs can also become valuable repositories for languages that are slowly disappearing.
Linda and I took a subset of these, the 100 or more Lirga song texts, and I analysed the language in these songs and then compared this with everyday Maringa that I'd learnt and was able to show that the language of the songs retains complexities that are gone in this dying language. In everyday language, it's simpler.
But aren't the songs quite newly composed in a way? I mean, they're not songs that have been around for hundreds of years. They might be around for a decade with a particular singer who wrote them.
Well, they were composed in the 70s and 80s, but at that time the language was much more frequently used than it is now. I mean, I spent the whole year of 2000 there in Wodeya and did a sociolinguistic analysis with a couple of Aboriginal helpers. And we found that nobody under 50 could speak these outlying languages fluently.
Honey Eater Singham, among the paperbark trees in my country, on the Moyle floodplain. Honey Eater, the Singham.
Obviously, language is a really vital element in understanding the songs. But I wonder if you can talk about the relationship of the text to the music in terms of, say, their rhythmic pattern.
Yeah.
Are they separate or connected?
Connected. What we're talking about are languages which have very long, complicated words. They're a bit like Latin and Greek. They have bits on the beginning, middle and ends of words that have grammatical meaning. A verb, for instance, might take up a whole sentence, and in that verb you will know who did what to whom, whether the person that was done to wanted it or not, or whether it was for their benefit, when it happened, how often it happened, whether it's yet to happen, whether the speaker can vouch for it as having happened. And a verb is one intonation group. It's very long. It may have up to 16 bits. One bit can't be separated, and you will get that reflected in the music. But I found that there are bits in the song text that actually contradict, you know, that they're put there for the meter, so that they don't have grammatical meaning. And if they did have grammatical meaning, it wouldn't work in the song. So they're actually only there as song additions. So that the music and the meter is incredibly important. You get things left out in songs put in ordinary speech, but it's still quite intelligible.
Make your way through the different layers of a song. You know, as you dig deeper, there's the superficial, here are the few words that are sung about here, but there's a whole lot more that's contained within the song.
I guess it's mainly hanging in there, you know. I mean, the Ben Mellor text basically says, Ben Mellor, Goodach, Goodach, he sang for him. Okay. Ben Mellor was a man, Goodach, Goodach was the bird. The first thing is it doesn't say who sang for whom. So some people said Ben Mellor sang for the kookaburra, and some people said the bird sang for the man. So that sort of set up a conundrum. And then we learned that Goodach Goodach wasn't in fact a kookaburra. That's what they tell the kids. But in fact, it's the channel-billed cuckoo, which is associated with death. And so we sort of knew we were dealing with a song that was about that bird calling someone away to death. And then much later, just, you know, partly through getting experience, I learned that when that channel bill cuckoo calls someone away to death, it's regarded as a natural death. That is, that there isn't any sorcery involved. So what started out as being a song that seemed to be about a man singing for a kookaburra or a kookaburra singing for a man actually turned out to be a song that channel bill cuckoo called out for that man, and really, so therefore, he didn't die of sorcery. He's sort of accepting that he died a natural death. So that process took several years, coming back, talking to people, and it sort of went on as a sort of conundrum for years and years.
I'm Linda Yarwin, and I work at the school, and I'm teaching culture at the school. So the kids can know their skin name and all that, learn their culture really strongly, so that's what I'm teaching the kids at the school.
Did you grow up around here?
Yeah, this is where I used to camp, other side. That's where I born.
Born here at the waterhole.
So this is my home.
All the Beluan babies come from this waterhole, and the waterhole knows them from their sweat, which is of the waterhole itself. If you're a woman and you swim here, you're inviting pregnancy, and I can see why. It's fertility in visual form. In the shelter of a gully, a narrow spring-fed creek runs into a deep glass-green pond of fresh water. From here it flows onward through a shallow grassy wetland. It's the most peaceful, beautiful place I've seen in a long time. On the last day of my visit, I steal a few moments to record the talkative corellas, the little wetland birds, a stick gently swirling the water. Then everyone arrives for the afternoon ceremonial launch of Alan Marrott's new book, Songs, Dreamings and Ghosts.
This is the main waterhole. This is our place in a dreaming. This is, we call it the Dam Beluan. And this is where they belong, the kids from here. And different sweat, they come in and swim in this water. It swirls, make it like our swirly one water. Comes up, it means that different sweat, wrong kid in this water. But if kids from here, Beluan, he probably knows that's his kids. It goes in here, you dive in, there's a tunnel, you find a tunnel that leads to the islands where the sites are. So this is the main thing that goes out, connected to the other dreamings.
Yeah.
What have I come to do? I'm going to sing, and then I'm going back. Now you sing.
It's very important in Balyuan that when singers learn to sing from their father or whoever it is that passes the song on to them, they actually try to imitate the voice of the singer. To the point where if you're listening to recordings, as for example, I was listening to some recordings that were made by Professor Elkin back in 1952 at Balyuan, and we knew that Tommy Bowditjup was there, and we knew that Jimmy Bunduck, who was the person from whom he received transmission, was also there because we could see it on a film. But Elkin hadn't recorded who was singing what, and so I sat down with people and to try and, you know, work out which was which. And people argued about it's Tommy, no, it's Jimmy, no. And in the end, you know, somebody said, look, the thing is, Alan, it's really difficult for us to tell because they had the same throat, you know, they had the same voice. And the importance of that for ceremony is that in ceremony where the singers and the dancers are all working to create this liminal state where, you know, one of the recently deceased can sort of move out of the society of the living and into the society of the dead. When that's going on, it's important, first of all, that the songs that are being sung and the dances that are being danced are things that have been given by the dead to the living. But it's also really important that when the singer is singing those songs, when, for example, Tommy is singing songs that he learnt from Jimmy, and I mean, when we say he learnt from Jimmy, I mean, we don't just mean when he was alive, but after his teacher had died, he continued to appear in his dreams and give him songs. When people are hearing that, they don't know, in a sense, whether they're hearing the voice of the living singer or whether they're hearing the voice of the deceased spirit. I mean, it's this sort of creation of a space that is partaking of both of those and which is of neither that makes the ceremony work. So that whole quality of voice is integral to that process.
Much of this story is about family. Music traditions around inheritance and performance practice show how a family is tied together. The didj player who died got his playing authority from an elder, Roy Bilbil, his uncle, Marjorie's husband. And then, after he passed on and entered the realm of the nguch, or ghost, he gave the song to his auntie Marjorie, to give in turn to his cousins, Roger Yarrowin and Lenny Berber. They come from round the Daly River area, from places like Emi Yangal and Marajavan country, so the family speaks several different languages.
My name is Kathleen Bilbil. I'm the eldest daughter for Marjorie Bilbil. Mr. Yarrowin was the eldest, but my dad was the youngest brother, so Yarrowins and Bilbils are we families, so we call ourselves brothers and sister.
Yeah, white people would say cousin.
Cousins. And that old lady, Auntie Alice, she's one of our full aunties. And my cousin mother passed away, from that country too. So what my dad done to the young cousin brother of mine is spit on the water, on the didgeridoo, spit it, and then pass it on to my cousin brother. That's why he got sand from his uncle, Mr. Aaron.
Because that's how you do it. You spit the water down the didgeridoo, yeah, and that passes it on.
Yeah. Mm. Same with my young brother.
Your brother too?
Yeah. One sitting up with a blue shirt up there. I can't really call his name. I'm not allowed to call his name. I just call him nickname Big Truck.
Yeah, Big Truck.
Ian Bilbil.
Yeah, anyway, I got that from my dad. Same way. Before, when I was young, there were so many crockery. When the old people was alive, it was very, very alive to me. It was,
all the time,
yeah. All the time, yeah. In the afternoon, I used to make fire, My dad used to blow didge.
When was that?
long time ago, no?
Yeah.
Used to go with her dad and dad used to blow the ditch for the old people.
Do you think television and radio changed it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Videos, DVD, television, all changed that thing, no?
You've actually, as somebody who's been given permission to sing at times, experienced just how connected these elements are with the dance. Can you describe how and what your experience was?
Yeah. I mean, when you're singing, right, so the singers are sitting in a group, if you like, at one end of the dance ground, and the dancers dance towards the singers.
And what does that feel like?
Well, I mean, it's amazing because, you know, what you're doing with the clapsticks at that point is actually completely locked into what the dancers are doing with their feet. And the dancers advance on you and they're sort of drawing on your energy and you're getting energy from them. And this is this incredible synthesis of the dancers' energies and the singers' energies. And it's amazingly exciting to have a bunch of dancers coming towards you in a cloud of dust and calling out to you and addressing you directly. I mean, focused on you, facing you, looking straight at you. And I think until I actually had that experience of sitting there and singing while people were dancing, I there's something that I hadn't really got about it. It's such a foreign idea that performance, dance and music are absolutely vital in the way that our libraries are, and they're the repositories of knowledge. They are really important mechanisms in giving people a sense of who they are and what their place is in the world. And if you can tap into ceremony, if you can help sustain ceremony, then you're working with something that actually really promotes personal health and health of the community. And again, I think that's why it's valuable, and that's why I think people enjoy working with us on these things. It's not just, you know, because we sit around and are entertained by listening to these things. I mean, we work really hard for hours and hours and hours on end. I mean, people are almost inexhaustible because it is so important, and it is so important to be paying attention to it. But I think it is really important in all of this, you know, not to get into a museum mentality and think that somehow that by recording and archiving Aboriginal music, we're sort of saving the tradition. What we should really be doing is saving the people. The real tragedy is the living conditions of people and the fact that the life expectancy in this area for men is 47 years, you know. Yeah, that's what brings it home to you, you know. Yes, you hear these statistics and they're shocking, but the real thing is there was this fabulous didgeridoo player. He was so talented. When he plays, it makes your hair stand on end. And at 40, he's gone.
Has having these CDs around for people to listen to, has it made a difference to the way people...
Yes, made a difference, a lot different.
In what way?
Like continue their cultures and making their robbery and songs stronger so the little kids can teach it to their younger generation and continue on.
Are the little kids really interested?
Yeah, they are. They have to follow their footsteps, you know, from their uncles or auntie like that. They have to continue.
What does it mean to the community that Marjorie's written this new song?
People got a lot to think about. You know, that's a good song about our country, father's side country. It's a place called Mabalo.
It's unusual for a woman to be given a song, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Why do you think Marjorie got it?
Probably she had a dream about it. And that's how she got it in her head and she
sang it then.
Yeah. Mm. When you become a singer, how do you know that you're going to be a singer?
It's just, you can feel it, you know. It's just a strong feeling and strong dream, you know. It's just like a spiritual way, eh? Like, yeah. You got that image and that you know that you're going to sing. Mm.
So you have to have a dream.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what my brother did.
Yeah.
Mm. So he continued singing the song.
I'm swimming. He's laying way down there, Marvelon. I swam. I came back to Marble Up, holding the canoe.
Ghost Songs was produced and narrated by Gretchen Miller, who visited Wat Eyre and Beluan in 2006. We heard Marjorie and Kathleen Bilbil, Linda Yarrowin, Ambrose Pialam, Alan Marrett, who's Professor of Musicology at the University of Sydney, from Linda Barwick, the archivist and musicologist and director of the Pacific and Regional Archive for Digital Sources in Endangered Cultures, and also from Lisbeth Ford, linguist and research fellow at the University of Sydney. And that program was produced in 2007. The sound engineer was Stephen Tilley. For more information on the National Recording Project and related endeavours, go to our website. There you'll also find some photos and some of Gretchen Miller's writings in her journal at the time of that trip. Just go to RN on the web and choose Into the Music from the list of programs on the page. Next week, Into the Music takes a long look at Igor Stravinsky, the Russian magician, on the centenary of his most famous composition, The Rite of Spring. Composer and academic Edward Cowie dissects most of Stravinsky's major works and shows how his style changed throughout his creative life and how it was related to the modernist movements of the time. Join me again tomorrow night at 9 for Away, when we meet the singer-songwriter who's written for Gurumul, who's been mentored by Mundawa Yunupingu and toured with Yothu Yindi. Rawan Maimaru stands on the shoulders of giants. And we visit the Mulka Project at Yirrkala, where the community is documenting their music and their way of life for future generations of Yolngu. Look forward to your company. Until then, keep safe and bye for now.